Welcome back, everybody, to Thin Line Believers podcast. I'm excited and extremely honored to have today's guest join us. Chris Fields is a retired Oklahoma City Fire major, having worked there for over 31 years and having retired in 2017. In a city the size of Oklahoma City, 31 years of rushing to calls in and of itself would bring back memories of certain calls, accidents, traumas, and death. On top of all that, Chris was one of the first on scene of the bombing of the Alfred P. Mura building, federal building, on April 19th, 1995, a bombing that we're all familiar with and bring back images in our own head, having not even been there, but seeing the coverage of it. This bombing killed 168 people, to include 16 children. The last number, 19 children and one particular child, is why Chris was thrown into the spotlight as a firefighter responding to the bombing site directly from his firehouse. Well, thank you for being here, Chris. And, you know, on that day that I'm sure changed your life, it sounds like you and your fellow firefighters actually felt the concussion of that blast as it went off.
Yeah, we were, just a minute, my phone's messing up here. Sorry.
Technical difficulties, that's all right, we all get them.
Let me fix this real quick. Anyway, yes, sir, that morning of April 19th, we had just been on duty a couple of hours, and we're sitting around the kitchen. Some guys were out taking care of the yard work. It was a Wednesday, and that was the day we did. If you were on duty on a Wednesday, you did the yard work around the station. So, and about 9 o'clock, we were talking about going to the store and getting some breakfast stuff. And we felt it, we heard it. The station, the windows rattled. We were 16 blocks north of the bomb site. My station was at the time, and so. We, you know, went outside to kind of look, see what happened. We actually thought a train maybe had derailed or something. There was a train tracks and a train yard across the street from us. And we saw the large plume of smoke from the from downtown, and just self-dispatched ourselves, knowing, you know, we were so close and that we would be dispatched eventually, or, you know, initially anyway. So we just self-dispatched ourselves that day, that morning. There was three rigs at my station. There was an engine, a rescue ladder, and I was the officer on the hazardous materials unit that day.
And so you guys show up at the scene and are just, I'm guessing, overcome by what you see and what you're dealing with, even in the moment. You know, I'm sure your training kicked in and all that, but to see something of magnitude had to have set you back.
Yeah, it was for the first probably 5 or 10 minutes, we really didn't get a image of the building or see what was going on. Right, catty corner from the Alfred P. Mura building, there was a YMCA building that had a daycare in it, and there was just a lot of walking wounded injuries, you know, flying debris and glass shattering and all that. So we were there for 5 or 10 minutes, kind of. One of the other officers set up a triage, and we were just, you know, running people through there. It was a lot of no life-threatening, but a lot of, you know, glass injuries and, like I said, you know, fallen debris, just some minor injuries. But, and then we got called by one of the incident commanders to come down to the building. He asked our location. We told him I wanted to go help the police department get a lady out of the basement. And that's when we really first got a glimpse of the building and saw, you know, one-third of the nine-story building, you know, down a 30-foot crater out front. And, you know, still at that point, I still remember, you know, stuff, debris and paper, still stuff floating down, you know, in the air, and there was car fires going on. And yeah, it was just, it was a chaotic scene. It was, I hate to say it, but it was like something you see out of a movie, just with that much destruction and the way the chaotic scene that was going on was just something, like you said, we never thought we'd see Oklahoma City, especially.
Yeah, for sure. Nothing we ever would think we would see in any city. I mean, let alone
hometown,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you guys started, you know, triaging and helping and treating the folks there. And at one point, a police officer walked up to you with a baby in his arms. And this is kind of where things changed and where your role in this whole thing nationally really exploded, for lack of better words, right? I mean,
right. We had helped the police department get a lady out of the basement, and she wasn't like trapped by debris and stuff. She was tangled up in like suspended ceiling wire, the acoustic ceiling and stuff. And so as we got her out, we had got another assignment. We were going to the south side of the building, and it was a police officer. At the time, I didn't know it was a police officer. I can look back at one of the photos now and see that he had his, it was John Avery. I'm still friends with him today, but I noticed he had a police hat on and a T-shirt and a gun. Never noticed any of that. I just kept saying this guy came out of nowhere. But and he just said he had a critical infant, and he was part of the people that were there, you know, pulling people out of the building as quick as they could. And, in 1995, police a little more are now, but you know, as far as first responder and medical aid and all that, you know, it's pretty much ambulance or the fire service doing it. So he was looking for somebody. He said, that's all he was screaming was, I have a critical infant. And, my mom always says there was a reason it was me. And like I said, there wasn't anything that I just said, you know, here, I'll take her. And yeah, he handed me Bailey, and, the first thing I did was check her for any signs of life. I had to take some, she had quite a bit of debris in her throat. I want to say it was, insulation, like concrete dust and stuff, what it was. You know, I cleared her throat. She had a little slight open skull fracture, and I didn't get any signs of life. And I happened to look up, and there was an ambulance across the street. And I walked her across the street and told the paramedic exactly the same thing Sergeant Avery said. I said, I have a critical infant. And the ambulance attendant was knelt down on the ground working on a lady, and the ambulance was full. There was a person on the floor, person up on the bench seat, and then they had a cot in there also. And then there was two or three people laying around on the ground in the on backboards. He just looked up at me, and he said, well, hold on a second. He said, I'm going to get a blanket. He said, we're not going to put that baby on the ground. Right. And that's when, you know, I didn't know there was a photo taken until 11:30 that night, and right, and didn't even see the photo until 6 o'clock the next morning. But after seeing the photo, knowing when it was taken by, that's when it was taken. I was standing there, and he was getting a blanket to put on the ground. I was just looking down at her thinking, you know, that somebody's world is going to be turned upside down today, you know. And, yeah, and at that time, of course, not knowing that thought or that feeling was going to be, you know, replayed 168 times, you know, throughout the day, mm-hmm, with all the other fatalities. And then that's not to mention the 500 to 700 that were injured. You know, some people today are still battling those injuries from that day, you know, both mentally and physically.
Oh yeah, sure. And, you know, being a first responder myself, you know, hearing you talk about that, I immediately flash back to the child injuries and those things that, you know, that still replay in your head, like you said, you know, it's, and I read an article where basically it quoted you saying, it's always devastating when it involves children, but when you have one, it hits home even more.
And that's pretty much, son, I had a son at home that was had just turned 2 years old, right? You know, and Bailey was 1 year old. So, you know, they're pretty really, really close in age at the time.
Yeah. And to just have that and knowing what it's like to hold a lifeless child when you have your child at home and just how that affects you. I can feel what you were feeling, not as the totality of that incident, but
right.
And knowing how, you know, that affects you going forward and the things that you deal with, you know, mentally and physically from those things.
Right.
Yeah. It's just heartbreaking. For sure. So this incident happens, and, you know, the picture is taken of you, and you almost become the face of this incident, if you will. You and little Bailey there, you know, this photo was taken and spread, and I believe it was a Pulitzer Award photo
in
the end.
Yeah, yes, it was. It was. And you know, it was, of course, you know, there were some struggles, man, but where I'm at now, you know, I just recognize that it was, it became a, you know, there were so many things going on that day, you know, and that was some of the stuff I struggled with, you know, the being singled out because I wasn't, you know, the only one that handled a fatality that day or, you know, just having to get caught on film. And, you know, it has come to symbolize the, and I very humbly accept the fact that it kind of symbolizes that day was, you know, I the firefighter represents, you know, all the rescuers, you know, firefighter, police, ambulance workers, I have to say we had to run civilians out of there, you know, that rushed in to help. And then, you know, Bailey represents just, you know, everybody that day, the innocence, not only just the innocence of, you know, Bailey being a child and the 19 children that were killed, but, you know, all the victims, even the ones that were injured, you know, and the innocence that was lost by our city that day.
Yeah, for sure. I know you've openly talked about your struggle with PTSD, not only from this incident, but from, you know, a accumulation of 30 years of being a firefighter and seeing and doing what you did. I was wondering if you'd touch on that a little bit for our listeners. It's something that we talk about a lot, and we put out there on this podcast because we know it's important to talk about these things and work through these traumas. You know, and I know you've said at one point that 30 or so years ago when you were retiring, you just didn't show emotion. You went on about your day, and we've come so far since then, you know. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to your struggle with that and your walk and your how you've managed that you know, in your personal life there.
Definitely. You know, I was I was hired in, you know, 1985 when I was hired. That was just, you just didn't talk about it. You know, I was kind of raised, you know, even growing up in little league sports and high school sports, I was just raised as an era when, you know, you just suck it up. That was just what we did, you know. Mm-hmm. Both in personal life, you just didn't open up to people, and especially in the fire service. You know, it was just things we didn't talk about. You just learned to suppress them and go on down the road. And, you know, that's what I did for a long time. A lot of my struggles initially were, and I've learned a lot. I'll go through it, but I'd like to preface by saying I learned a lot about cumulative trauma, which I had no idea, you know, that it was even building up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I learned about triggers and all sorts of stuff. But at the beginning, a lot of the things I struggled with, especially with the photo and stuff, was some guilt issues. You know, guilt's one of those, sometimes it's rational, but it's also irrational sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it'll, it doesn't matter if it's rational or irrational, it'll eat you alive. And I was feeling guilty for the photo happening, you know, out of my control, but I watched Aaron not get to grieve privately. Aaron is Bailey's mother, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Allman. She didn't get to grieve privately. Everything was a news article, or, you know, they found photographers hiding in trees at Bailey's funeral trying to get pictures, you know. And I mean, it was just, she didn't get to grieve privately, you know. And and then talking with Aaron, which we're still great friends today. Our family's great friends with her family. But, you know, after she found out that Bailey was deceased, you know, she had to go identify. Well, she didn't get a hold or touch or nothing. So I'm the last person that she has contact with that she knows that, you know, so to be the last one to hold somebody else's child in that situation weighed, like I say, and that's just that irrational guilt, you know, that I put on myself. And then in the fire service, man, it's such a team oriented deal. And that day was such a team effort from all the first responders, and then, you know, not to mention the USAR teams that came in from out of state to help us. And so to be singled out was weighing pretty heavy on me. I had outstanding support though from the men and the women of Oklahoma City Fire Department and the administration. I mean, but it was just that. I guess because it was covered for so long too, you know, it was just a continuous every day. There was something, and that's a lot of things I struggled with. I learned just to kind of push it down and go on about my business, because I didn't want the chiefs and stuff that had put me in a supervisor's position to think I couldn't handle my job. That was a fear, you know, back then. I didn't want, of course, to think, you know, the guys and girls that worked underneath me, I didn't want them to think that I couldn't handle my job, you know. So you're kind of, you play that role where I go to the station and act like everything's great. I had really learned to just, what I would say, manage it, just like we do throughout a career. About eight, and this was a process. I mean, it wasn't like all of a sudden I was having trouble. It was, you know, just that little bit of dealing with the guilt and struggling, but I just kind of learned to cope with it. And then we were putting in a pool in our house in 1995, 10 years later. And a lot of people don't know it rained the night of the bombing in 1995. Oh, wow. So you had the wet concrete dust smell and all that. I'm helping the guys bust out some of my patio, and it started to rain, and I caught a smell of wet concrete dust, you know, and I didn't like freak out. I didn't lose control, but in my mind I thought, oh my gosh, that smells just like the day of the night of bombing.
Wow.
Just that wet concrete dust.
Mm-hmm.
And I can trace it back to, I know after that I started realizing or noticing, and I may have been doing it all along, but I really started to notice that I was getting a little more withdrawn from mm-hmm. my family, a little more battling the depression, a little more reliving the guilt I felt for you know, from the photo and all that kind of stuff. And my wife noticed it. She would try to talk to me about it. But as first responders, we're protectors, and I want to protect my family. I didn't want to lay that off on my family, you know.
Right.
That's another thing. That's what we do.
Absolutely.
That's what we were conditioned to do, you know. And it just gradually got worse, and I knew it, but I didn't want to. Of course, when I go to the fire station, everything was great. I could hide it perfect for them.
Right.
You know, one of the things I've learned now, that my deal was, I was more concerned with my legacy at the fire department and at the fire station than I was with my own family and my own friends. Because of the fact that, you know, when I went there, everything was great. I was happy-go-lucky. I was Mr. Funny Guy, and always, you know, that's just always kind of in a good mood. But when I would come home, I would just go into my reclusiveness and my depression would kind of, I don't know, it was just a vicious cycle I couldn't get out of. And it led to more stress in the home, and it led to me and my wife arguing more. And then that's where things kind of really started spiraling out of control, as far as in my personal life, my marriage life. We weren't getting along. So I thought, well, I'm going to go do what I want to do to be happy. So I was running around with, you know, guys, single buddies that I shouldn't have been running around with, led to an extramarital affair. It led to eventually me leaving the house. Me and my wife were separated for 17 months.
Wow.
And it was just a constant game that I was playing. You know, and I always want to preface and say, you know, I ended up being diagnosed with PTSD, and I'll get into all that, but, you know, none of that. All my actions were conscious decisions that I made. But you get to a point to where you feel like I was to a point to where I feel like I had alienated people so much and screwed up enough that it didn't matter. So I thought, you know, well, I'm just going to do what I want to do. I've screwed this deal up. Let's go over here and see if I can screw something else up or maybe start new, you know. That's just kind of where I was. And I've been to the doctor a few times for, you know, the depression, anxiety, and I'm just calling a total blank on what they gave me. One of those, you know, prescriptions you can get for your depression and your anxiety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would help at night. They would help me relax, and they'd help me, you know, get some sleep. So I thought, well, if a anti-anxiety and anti-depression pill works, just think how well it'll work with a little alcohol. So I got into kind of mixing those two together, and like I say, and it wasn't a didn't become like an addictive need, but there'd be nights where I would, if I wanted to get some good sleep and escape and not think about things, that's what I would do. Mm-hmm. And it got pretty intense. I mean, I've always told people in the past, I used to say, I wasn't suicidal. I never thought about suicide. But then when I look back and say, okay, I got to the point where I was mixing such a level of this antidepressant with alcohol that I had been on enough first aid calls. I knew what an accidental overdose was. You know, I knew.
Right.
I knew the chance I was taking. But I was to the point again where I was more worried about Chris Fields' image. So I wouldn't want him to think, Chris Fields committed suicide. Well, you know, because that image that comes with when you commit suicide, you know, that stigma.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I'm just going to do what I do. And, you know, if I accidentally take too much, You know, it was an accident because Chris Fields would never do that to himself because he was perfectly happy with the way his life was going because that's the persona I was projecting to everybody.
Yeah.
And it came to a point one night I had, sat there and thought about everything I had done. You know, I basically left my 17-year-old son at home to be the man of the family, told him, you know, take care of your younger brother. My youngest was 11 at the time. And, you know, I had alienated all my friends and my family and humiliated my wife publicly. And so when I went to bed that night and took my little cocktail to help me sleep and forget about it, I woke up about 2:30 in the morning and was in a massive sweat, kind of like a panic attack. And I woke up in this little apartment I was living in. I was looking for my family. And the strange thing was I was looking for my boys, like in their infant stages, in their young stages.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I remember laying down in the living room floor, crying and upset. And then I really don't know if I passed out, fell asleep, or what I did. But I woke up about 5 in the morning and was just laying there looking up and thinking. And it just hit me. I said, there is no way that this is my purpose or God's purpose in my life.
Yeah.
I just came to a point. I was just at a point where it just came over me. And I had gone through all the angry at God issues, you know, because my mom, she's my prayer warrior. She's this, and she can't always say, you know, there's a reason, son, there's a reason it was you. And there, so in my mind, I'm going, well, God's got a funny way of showing what the reason was, you know. So I went through a lot of anger stuff. And so when I was laying there thinking, you know, if I've got a breath in my body, there's no way this is my purpose. And I get to speak a little bit about it now and I get to talk about it. But, you know, I wasn't saying that's my purpose is to rebound and go speak. I said, my purpose is to be a good father and a good husband.
Absolutely.
And that's not what I was doing. So I called my wife, who should be sainted, and I said, I told her, I want to come home. And I had a guy ask me about 2 months ago, I was telling my story, and he said, at what point did you feel like when you made the decision to turn your life around and get it straightened out, when did you know that you were on the right track and you made the right decision? And I can say wholeheartedly, it was when I called my wife and said, I want to come home. And her reply was, then come on.
Wow.
So I knew right then, that I thought, because that wasn't the response I was expecting, you know.
Right, yeah.
and you know, we kind of make little jokes about it now. You know, she said, come home. But it was like, but there's, you know, there's going to be some rules and some changes, you know.
Uh-huh.
that we have to. So that's when I really got serious about seeking some counseling, and I started looking for. I went to our fire department chaplain, who got me in with a. I had seen some like just regular family therapists and stuff like that for some of my issues. Just wasn't a connection for me. I mean, I don't think they knew. Well, they said, I don't know. They when they say I know how you feel, I'm thinking in my mind, no, you don't. You haven't seen the things or done the things. You know we've done, and you haven't lived your life the last 18 months like I've lived mine. So you really don't know. You know, so I got finally in with a clinician that had done. It's all she's done is with first responders dealing with PTSD and all this stuff. And this was us until 2009.
Oh,
so
wow.
Here we are. Yeah, so here we are with that 14 years after the bombing, you know.
Right.
Before. And so I finally, you know, dive in head first to the counseling and diagnosed with PTSD. And the lady I was seeing introduced me to what's called EMDR therapy. And I couldn't explain it if I had to, but it allowed me to talk about traumatic events without having their reactions to the events, you know.
Yeah. Basically, reprograms how you react. From what
right,
I understand
right.
of
you know,
it, yeah.
And which without knowing, you know, like that's why I tell people all those reactions that guys and girls have when they go on traumatic calls. Those are normal. You're a human being. So any reaction you have is just normal. We've got to get to that point to where we know that if you're upset on a certain call, that it's just normal, you know. But
That's okay, right.
So anyway, after you know, when doing the EMDR and talking about things, and it took me to places that I'd never thought I would go as far as cumulative trauma over my life and 31 years on the job, you know. Well, at that time, it was not quite 31 years, but 20-something year career at that time when I was going through all this part. But, you know, and it was and a lot of it was irrational guilt about things. One thing that, you know, that really was a hurdle and I got over that at this time I was 40-something years old and that 45 years old, and nobody had ever, my family, my wife, nobody, that I finally told the my clinician that was, you know, when I was molested at 10 years old. And that was a huge, that was the first time anybody besides me that, you know, that I had said anything to. And that in itself, you know, working through that, processing through that, removing that guilt and that stigma from myself, helped me to just, I mean, it was a, I don't know, it was a cakewalk from there. I mean, it really was. I mean, I went through a lot of counseling with, you know, previous issues. You know, I've lost five or six, you know, brothers on the job, line of duty, you know, in those years on the job. And as firefighters, first responders, we like to, you know, we go to the funerals, we cry, we hug, talk about it. We don't process it.
Oh yeah,
and I have learned there's a huge difference in just, you know, talking about it with a buddy, and you hug each other and you cry and you talk about how you miss him and you talk or her and you talk about the stories, you know, but you don't ever process the way you feel, and you know that it's okay to feel the way you're feeling. It's okay not to be okay sometimes. And
we're kind of like that big family that gets along and loves each other, but when it comes to talking about our feelings, it's like no, we don't do that here.
Exactly. And like I said, so and once I got through that, you know, and processed a lot of the other, you know, and trauma is so different for everybody. What's traumatic to me is not traumatic to you, and it's not always the big significant events, you know, just like the bombing. To me, and a lot of people think, oh, he was diagnosed with PTSD because of the bombing in the photo. No, I think that was just a catalyst, really, to kind of kickstart.
Part of that overall cumulative, you know,
right.
Mass it was, that, it,
It was the thing that finally, I get, you know, old saying, the straw that broke the camel's back. That was the thing that put me over the top, I guess, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
And I always tell people that the two lessons I've learned the most, because, you know, it was strictly it was my faith and my family that got me through. I don't do a whole lot of speaking, but when I do, I never shy away from my faith. Now, there are some crowds where I don't go deep into it because I don't want to lose them, because I know how firefighters are. You know, they're sitting out in the crowd and they're going, oh, okay, he's going to preach to me.
Oh, here we go.
They'll check out mentally, you know, if they think you're preaching to them. But I don't shy away from it. You know, God is my, you know, Lord, my Savior. But I always just tell people, you have to believe in something bigger and greater than yourself. I'm not preaching to you and telling you this is how you got, but if all I believe in is myself, good Lord, how disappointed am I? You know? So I think there's got to be something bigger and better. And, you know, and that, like I say, that's that night I was on the floor and just thought, okay, there's got to be a purpose and there's got to be a reason. And like I said, I was looking just to get back and to be the father and the husband I needed to be. And, you know, and all this other stuff that I'm getting to do now is just a blessing. And so, like I say, I tell people two of the most valuable lessons I've taken away from it is mama's always right and everything's on God's timing.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, those are my mom said it from day one. You know, Chris, there was a reason. There, you know, God's going to use you with it, you know. And of course, I went through my anger deal and wanted to know when he was going to, you know. So here we are 25 years later, and I've just, you know, I've probably been speaking publicly now about it for about a year. So 24
wow.
years after the event is when God said, now you're ready.
Well, you know, and it's amazing how hard the enemy works to make sure that we don't turn into that person, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we don't use these incidents that should be negatives as a positive, you know, that we can't, you know, everything that he threw at you with your family life and your personal life and substances and all of these things to try and keep you down and to break you, just to have that become your testimony and your story of, yeah, you know what, the enemy worked hard on me, but here I am today and I've got my family back and I've got my health back and I've got, you know, and just giving all that glory to the Lord. I mean, just is
right.
Is a true testament of who you are and where you've come from.
Exactly. You know, and like I said, I'm so thankful that I had that base to even fall back on and believe in because of my family and my mom, the way she raised me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So like I say, it was a huge, huge impact on my life. And like I said, it's just a point to where, you know, these suicide rates amongst first responders and all that stuff is just out of control. And,
yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, it's just such a, I see it now. Of course, when I was going through it, you know, I was right. Everybody else was wrong. The friends that I alienated were just the ones that didn't agree with what I was doing, you know. But it's just, it's such a simple that it's okay not to be okay sometimes. And we have to get to that point. You know, I try to tell the young guys and girls that I get the opportunity to talk to that, you know, trauma is different for everybody. If you feel like you're struggling with the emotion from a call, it's still thinking, you're thinking about it a couple of days later, talk to somebody, talk to a family member, if you feel comfortable going to your officer or your supervisor, talk to them. I mean,
right.
it's a different culture on the fire department. I think I would feel comfortable going to talk to a supervisor now about it. You know, 25 years ago, I wouldn't, but I always try to tell them, I don't speak. It's not a scare tactic. I'm not saying, I do tell them for sure, you will experience trauma on this job. You cannot avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, but just because you experience trauma doesn't mean you're going to be diagnosed with PTSD. Doesn't mean you're going to have to go away and be treated. It doesn't even mean you're going to have to go see a counselor. You may be one of those type that talk about it with a best friend or your wife, and that helps you, you know, get that emotion out and deal with it.
Right.
So that's what I try to just tell them, that it's just talking about it and trying to, like I say, deal with it a little bit and break that stigma of reaching out. I always like to tell them we have to take care of each other. We got to look out for each other. I always make a point that administrations and cities, they have jobs to do. They don't,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying they're heartless and cold, but they don't worry. I mean, I always tell them, you know, Chris Fields did 31 years, 7 months, and 16 days. On March 1st, 2017, I retired. We had a great party. Everybody said, hey, man, appreciate it. I said, you know what happened on March 2nd? They promoted a guy and put him in my seat on the fire engine, and things went right on. I mean, they clicked like nothing, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're not going to – we have to look out for each other. I'm not scared to ask anybody if they're doing okay anymore, which that was always kind of a no-no, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, just leave them alone, you know, let them – they'll be all right. But we've got to in this profession, first responders, not just firefighters, but the whole first responder world, we got to look out for each other. Period.
Absolutely. And so many departments now have, you know, peer support teams and SISM teams. And I mean, just how far things have come, probably just even in the time that you were, you know, a firefighter, just seeing that progression to where we're kind of going towards today has got to be a good thing for you to see. I mean, I've seen it just in the 16 years that I've been an officer here in Oregon, just the progression of how it's been.
Oh, definitely. And like I said, and I don't fault Oklahoma. In 1995, our administration and fire people, fire chiefs and all that, and they did exactly what they knew to do at that time. They did bring in a team from, you know, it was just kind of on the brink. You know, we had, I think, a CISM team back then.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, things didn't go real well. There was, you know, John Doe goes in and talks to Sally on the SISM team, and then next thing you know, John Story's floating around the fire departments, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean,
yep.
You just, there was just something, it was so new, but the administration, you know, they did, they afforded every opportunity that they, you know, knew at the time. They just did what they knew, but
yeah.
Things have come so far with the peer support groups, and, you know, I know I've talked to several departments across the country where they said, hey, you know, we'd like to have you come in and speak to our rookie class or something, but our fire chief really doesn't, you know, they think if these people hear that, then they'll be focused on that, and then they'll have people lined up at their door wanting off saying, I got PTSD. I want, you know, I just, I mean, there's still people that are that, I mean, it's not like something you could catch, you know, but I mean, but they're still, but I mean, it is so, so much better than it was, and it's getting better all the time. Administrations are seeing, hey, if we will do some preventative stuff, teach them resiliency, let them know up front. You know, in rookie school, 1985, all we were pretty much taught was, this is how you turn the plug off, the hydrant off and on. Do what your officer says, you know, and be in the best physical shape you can. There was nothing about mental stuff. There was nothing. Oklahoma City Fire Department now, in their rookie classes, they actually have me and two other guys go have a day for mental health where we go speak. And then they also have a day. And then the other half of the day is financial planning. They bring in a financial guy to tell these young guys and girls that are just getting on the job, hey, this is what you should be. This is the way to, you know. So that was just stuff that just wasn't, you know, part of the culture back then.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
Well, Chris, I wonder if you would just share kind of a closing word for our people, for our thin line believers, just maybe some words of advice going forward for them. You know, we always are big on talking about our faith and, mm-hmm. and our mental health and, you know, just all the things that challenge, you know, us on the thin line and first responders. Maybe just share some words of wisdom as we close out.
You know, it's just, like I said, it's just a simple, to me, it's just a simple phrase of it's, you know, it's okay not to be okay sometimes. And it's a, have somebody that you can have a go-to person, no matter who that person is. And if you're like me now, man, take it to the Lord in prayer. I mean, I still have things come up, but on some tough days. But I know I can always. It's funny that no matter I can be having a bad day and something will click up, and there's always, for me, there's always a scripture that relates to whatever I'm dealing with. You know, and when I get into that and read it, I find out that I think, okay, I'm about to make a mountain out of a molehill when, you know, this right here tells me this, that, you know, it's going to be okay. He's going to be there. And I've learned, and I think for me, I learned that, to recognize that for me, everything was in God's timing. I wanted him to reveal to me, you know, right then why I was going through what I was going through and what his plan was. So I just tell everybody just to do not be scared to reach out. Like I said, it doesn't mean you're going to lose your job or be diagnosed with PTSD. One of the biggest things that I remember is when I finally got to my lowest point, and that's one thing I want to stress. You don't have to get – don't wait until you get to your lowest point.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
But once I did and I reached out, I was amazed and I was humbled, totally humbled by the amount of people that were reaching out to, you know, reaching back to me to help. It was a humbling experience. So that's what I would tell people. Just, you know, it's okay not to be okay sometimes. And not being okay doesn't mean you're in a crisis or you break down. It's just those feelings after a traumatic event are normal. And so you know, Be willing to reach out and talk if you need to.
Okay. Well, if I hear what you said, talk to somebody. Doesn't matter who it is. Talk to somebody.
Yep.
Pray often.
Yep.
Get in the Word. And, you know, just don't be afraid, because there are so many of us that are going through that same thing and have gone through that same thing.
That is true, too. That's one of the most amazing things, is that you think you're alone out on this island, and I learned so quick that I am no different than any other first responder, and no first responder than any different than me. We're humans. We have feelings and emotions, and those are gonna come up when we experience traumatic event, not in our life, but when, you know, when we respond on other people and know how their life's affected by them. So,
All right. Well, Chris, I am honored to have you, and thank you for taking the time to speak some wisdom and truth into my life and into our listeners' lives. And bless you, and may the Lord keep you and do those things that He's been doing for you.
Same to you, Steve. Bless you and your podcast. I think it's great, man. It's just keep reaching out to people, and maybe we'll get this deal whipped.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right.
With that, we will be with you again next week, and tune in, and we'll have some more topics and tools and all that to help you out. Have a blessed week.